The four Gospels record 173 questions asked by Jesus, but what stands out about them is that most often they were asked not for his sake, but for the sake of the one being asked. Jesus asked questions not because he needed to know, but because the one being asked did. To put it simply, Jesus asked questions that more times than not we are too afraid or unaware to ask ourselves.
All right. Well, good morning, Westside. It is good to see you here on this Remembrance Day, what has turned into a long weekend. Not always a long weekend on Remembrance Day, but this year it just works out that way. So great to have you. Know a few Westsiders have headed out of town, but if again, you are a guest, as Chad mentioned, special welcome to you. My name is Norm, one of the pastors here at Westside. If you have a Bible in book or app form, please take it out. Turn with me to the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 14. We're looking at verses 22 to 33. We took a 1 week hiatus from our series on questions Jesus asked last week. We are now back into it this week, a series that we began in September. We'll run through the first week in December before we get into the Christmas season, which is just right around the corner. So as you find Matthew 14, let me pray and then we'll get into this great text. Good to have you here. Father, guide us now, I pray, through your word, your written word to us. This is your gift to us, your grand gift to us. And I pray, Father, that we would have, as I pray all the time, eyes to see, ears to hear what you have for us. Help us, by your grace, through the power of your Spirit, to lay aside those distractions that so often come and snatch that which is planted in us in times like this. So I pray against that. I pray your Holy Spirit would guide us against those things. Help us to stay away from those things, lay aside those things that hinder our hearing from you. You want to speak to us, so I pray that you'd give us ears to hear what your Spirit is saying this morning. Help me as the proclaimer, help all of us as listeners, that you would be glorified in this and that we would be joy-filled and strengthened on our continuum of faith. And I pray for these things in Jesus' great name. Amen. Good to be back with you, by the way. This particular text, Matthew 14, 22 to 33, records one of the more well-known events in the Gospels, four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, kind of like biographies of Jesus written by either Jesus' disciples or those that have been close to a disciple of Jesus, recording some of the major events, the more important events of his life. This is one of them. It's a well-known one, even if you didn't grow up in the church. It's the recording of Jesus walking on the water and Peter joining him thereafter. It's a really big, fun text. We're going to take a lot out of it. But what we need to get right from the get-go and understand from the get-go is that this particular event serves as a living parable. And what I mean by that is that it's more than just simply a record in the life of Jesus. It's more than just a record of another of his great and miraculous signs and wonders. It serves as a living parable, like a spoken parable. Jesus spoke in parables oftentimes. They were earthly stories that expounded heavenly meaning. So too, living parables like this one. We're going to see a lot of things from it. I'm actually going to highlight five of them that I think we need to glean out of this great event. There are more, but let me highlight five. Let me give them to you on the front end, then I'll double back and we'll hit them one by one. The five things, if you're taking notes, Jesus sends us into storms, number one. Number two is Jesus keeps us in storms. Number three, Jesus enters our storms. Number four, Jesus teaches us in the midst of storms. In fact, uses storms to teach us. And then finally, Jesus calms our storms. If you put your pretty eyes down in verse 22, the very first word that you'll come across in Matthew 14 is the word immediately. Really important word. Comes up three times, actually, in this particular text in verses 22, 27, and then we'll see it in verse 31. It's important for a couple of reasons. One, it gives us sort of the vibe of what's going on. When you see the word immediate, there is this sense of, man, this is happening fast. There is some tension. We need to get from here to there. Lots of things happening from that standpoint, but even more importantly than the vibe that this particular word gives us in this event, it also points back. It causes us to point back to something that's taking place or has taken place. The word immediate, as you see it in verse 22, points back to what most New Testament theologians suggest as being the most important or most telling of Jesus' messianic signs. Now, when I say that, I know some of you will want to go, well, what about his resurrection? I mean, isn't that the most telling sign? Well, yes, thereafter. But if you were one longing, waiting for the Messiah to come, you didn't have that in mind. In fact, that was entirely out of your scope of connection with the Messiah. So when we see the life of Jesus and the signs and wonders, there were ones that really spoke, really affirmed who he was. This is one of them. It's telling for us, and it's important because of its scope. There were 5,000 men. That's how they counted in those days. Therefore, about 10, 15, perhaps even 20,000 people that took part in the feeding of what is called the feeding of the 5,000, the event that paves the way to the one that we're looking at today. The most important, again, as people suggest, because of its scope, but also because of what it invoked in the minds of those who participated in it. Let me give you a little history lesson. If you were a devout Jew, and you were therefore well-versed, right, gave yourself to the understanding of your history and story, literally God's story, recorded in what we call the Old Testament, what they would call their Bible or their scriptures. You would then, because you had given yourself to that particular study, you would have been looking forward to, longing for the arrival of the Messiah. I've talked about this in the past. The reason why you would is because your Bible was chock full of promises that one was coming. And all of a sudden one day you hear about this guy that's come along that's making some bodacious claims and doing some pretty cool stuff, but you're not really sure, so you want to check him out. You start following him, and you're not alone. Literally thousands are following him at this particular time. And then one fateful late afternoon, you find yourself, now note it in verse 13, in a desolate place. Think wilderness. It's late afternoon. Oh, lo and behold, no food. No food at all. No big deal, however. Because the one you're following takes care of your hunger needs. And he takes care of your hunger needs by essentially making abundance out of literally nothing. With leftovers. How many leftovers? 12 basketful of leftovers. Now, if you're longing for the Messiah and you know your story, a story of a nation made up of 12 tribes, a nation that has a wilderness exodus event, a nation that went through that wilderness exodus event following Moses. Moses, who said the one who is going to come is going to be like me, leading you on a more important, more significant exodus. One who, while he led them through this wilderness event, saw forth by God's grace their food needs taken care of. Plentifully. Manna from heaven. And now one day you longing, you following, you listening to this one who's making grand claims, you experienced this. What are you thinking? He's here. He's here. He's arrived. Fantastic. This is fantabulous. He's here. Finally, he is here. Fired up. But here's the problem. Remember Peter? Peter, right? We're going to see him again today. Peter, you're the Christ. Peter, get behind me, Satan. Peter, remember we talked about Peter going, he knew who Jesus was, sort of incomplete picture, going from you are the Christ, son of the living God, to again, Peter, get behind me, right? Shut up. Don't tell anybody about me because you really don't know enough about me. That Peter. So too with the crowds. So too with the crowds. Incomplete understanding of who the Messiah was. But here is the thing. This is a way more dangerous event. Because that one-on-one with Peter, which is, again, a one-on-one with Peter, Jesus and Peter. Here we got literally tens of thousands. And they are fired up. And they are tired of the Romans. And they're hungry. And they are wanting their rightful place as God had promised. And all of a sudden this takes place. When John records the aftermath of the feeding of the 5,000, I want you to note what he records about the crowd and Jesus and his response to them. John chapter 6, verse 15, we read, perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. See, they're thinking, this is great. Our king's here. Our genie in the bottle's here. Our free food is here. the overthrow of the Romans has arrived through this guy. We'll set him up. He doesn't want to, we'll force him. Everything's going to be hunky-dory, peachy keen. They had much to learn. But so too did Jesus' disciples. They weren't any farther along. In fact, in the wake of the event that we're about to walk through, look how Mark records the place of the disciples. When he writes, "And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased, and they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, the feeding of the 5,000. Why? Because their hearts were hardened. So the disciples aren't any farther along than the crowds, really. Misunderstanding, incomplete understanding. And so what does Jesus do? He wants them out of there. He wants them out of that particular scene right away. And so what does he do in the tense aftermath of the feeding of the 5,000? Take a look at verse 22. Immediately. Just note that. Immediately he made the disciples get into the boat, go before him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds. Now, a lot to feel in this. Again, there's tension, right? This isn't just, "Hey, man, thanks for the picnic. See ya." This is tense, man. Get out of here. Get on the boat. Go fast. I'll get rid of them. I want you to sense, in the midst of all that, the protection of Jesus. Specifically to his disciples, for his disciples. "Get in the boat. I don't want you dragged along by the crowd. This is a dangerous time. You have much to learn. Get out of there." And immediately they did, and with him sending them away begins the teaching of Jesus, and it begins this way, by sending his disciples into a storm, number one. They had much to learn, incomplete, and their learning would begin by Jesus sending them into a storm. And what does Jesus do as he sends them off? Look at verse 23. "And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray." Think mountain overlooking the sea, okay? Think that kind of picture. "When evening came, he was there alone." Now, the greatest miracle, by the way, in this event is the one that's not even recorded, and that is, how do you get away from that many people? He's Jesus. "That's the best I got for you, and that's the greatest I got for you." It wasn't his time. So he got away. He got away from this group of people who wanted to set him up by force. He got away. And as was his practice, he prayed. This was Jesus' practice. He went to the crowds, and then he went to desolate places to pray. We don't know what he prayed for, but I think we can assume some things. Probably prayed for the crowds who just didn't get it. Prayed for them, prayed for their hearts and their minds. I'm sure he prayed for ongoing strength by the Spirit, because Jesus was empowered by the Spirit for ministry, setting an example for us and how we are to be empowered, spending time in prayer, being filled with the Spirit, empowered for ministry. So I'm sure that he did that, prayed for ongoing strength as he would again encounter the enemy and those that the enemy was using against him. I'm sure he was praying for the next stage in ministry. See, when you read there that he went to the other side, don't just think the other side of the sea. He was literally going from Jewish territory to Gentile territory. This is a new stage of ministry. That's why just a little ways later in the book of Matthew, you read about the feeding of the what? 4,000. Feeding of the 5,000 in Jewish territory. Here's your Messiah, here's the new Exodus, but it's not reserved just for Jewish people. It's also reserved for Gentile people. I'm the Messiah of them too. So he was praying, I'm sure, for this next stage of ministry, but as well, he must have been praying for his disciples in the storm they had just entered. Praying for them and what they were about to go through. And after an evening of prayer, we read in verse 24, "But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them." So what do we get here? Well, we get that this was a bad storm. They were beaten by the waves. They were beaten by the wind. In the other accounts that Mark and John write about this event, Mark's account tells us that they were making headway painfully. John's account tells us that the sea was rough. Again, this is a rough, arduous, hard, painful journey. And make no mistake, Jesus sent them into it. Now, I know what the skeptic is thinking. He didn't know a storm's coming. He didn't know a storm's coming. Couple of responses to that. First of all, there are just way too many places in the Gospels that record the foreknowledge of Jesus to believe that. Secondly, however, and I think more importantly, it is in the very nature and practice of God to send us into storms. In fact, it's his MO. It's what he does. He sends us into storms. Storms not of our doing. Although there are storms that we create for ourselves, and I'll talk about those on the back end, but storms like this one of his doing, the storms that he creates. Storms not meant to punish. Storms meant to teach and mold and build and test. I mean, think about the story of God. I mean, you see events like this all the time. I mean, Abraham called to sacrifice his son Isaac in Genesis 22 begins, and God tested Abraham. What about Job? I mean, Job is introduced to Satan by God. Heard a speaker talking about that this week, saying, you know what? Hey, God, all right, if you think well of me, just keep it between the two of us. Don't tell Satan about me at all. Sort of that idea, you know, God introducing Satan to Job. If you consider Job, what about Paul? A thorn in the flesh given, this messenger of Satan to Paul to keep him from being pride-filled. What about Jesus himself? Immediately following his baptism, it says the Spirit led, really pushed Jesus into the wilderness to be tempted. He uses the word tempted by Satan. So we see this. It's God's MO. Now, if this creates internal tension for you, let me add to it, okay? Let me add to your internal tension by stating that Jesus not only sends us into storms, he keeps us in the storm. He keeps us in storms. Keeps us there. Why do I say that? Well, notice verse 25 where we read, and in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. What's a watch of the night? Well, 3-hour increments starting at 6 p.m. So the fourth watch of the night took place between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. So let's timeline this together, okay? Dinner, fish, bread. That's why there were leftovers. No, that's not true. No, I can't have any more. Lasagna? No leftovers. Fish and bread, dinner, right? Dinner? Immediately, they got to get out of here. Get out of here, get out of here. I'll take care of this group. Get out of there. Evening of prayer. Evening of prayer. And Jesus, in that prayer, takes his merry time getting to his disciples. He actually waits almost till daybreak. So when you timeline this, they've been on the water for 6, 7, 8, perhaps 9 hours for a trip that should have been done pretty quickly. Adding on to this, listen to what Mark states about this event at this particular time when he writes, and Jesus saw that they were making headway painfully. For the wind was against them, and about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass them by. Thanks. That's fantastic. This is like the antithesis of the footprint poem. You know the footprint poem? You know what I'm saying? You know that one that sold millions, right? When there's one set of footprints... Right, this is when you picked me up at my hardest time and you carried me. This one, this poem written out of this, it's like during my hardest time when my footprints were there. Yours kind of veered away. You know what I mean? I mean, someone should write that poem. Like you would sell tens of them. Right? You know, that's this. I mean, what is going on? I mean, Jesus could see before he even hit the water that they were struggling, but no biggie, he was going to pass on by. What do we get in this living parable at this stage? Well, please get at least this much. Jesus sends them into a storm. He watches them in the storm. He leaves them in the storm, and he is about to walk by while they battle the storm. Why? Because they had something to learn. They had something to learn about themselves, but more pointedly, they had something to learn about how they viewed Jesus that only a storm could teach. teach. Now, before you conclude that Jesus is some sort of cruel puppet master, I want you to note that Jesus doesn't just send them and keep them in their storm, nor us just send us or keep us in our storm, but Jesus enters our storms too, but not before freaking the crap out of them. Take a look at verses 25 and 26. Note what goes on here. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It is a ghost." And they cried out in fear. The word ghost is too soft here. It's the Greek word phantasma, phantom. It's connected to evil spirits, the demonic. So put yourself in the place of a disciple. You're rowing hard, 7-8, you're tired, you're freaked out, storm overwhelming you, and adding just absolute tension to this, you now think you've been visited by something demonic. That's where you're at right now in verse 26. Let me ask you a question. Does your theology, what you believe about God, does your theology have enough room for a God who is willing to put us in places of fear where all we can do is cry out? Do you have room for a God who loves you that much? You're going, what? Okay, I understand the first part of the question. What do you mean loves me that much? I mean loves you that much. Do you have room for a God like that? I mean love you enough to confront those things in your life that only a storm can, causing you to cry out so as to be deepened, broadened, strengthened, and matured, therefore loves you that much? Or is your theology one where God only exists to provide you food with leftovers and make sure all things are smooth sailing thereafter? A lot of people leave. They leave following God because they don't like that one. They like the leftover provision God, smooth sailing God. That one? No. If God is like that, then I won't believe in him. So I ask again, do you have room for a God like this? See, at Westside, we exist to make Jesus known. We talk about it all the time, but understand that Jesus, our God, is the type of God who sends disciples into storms, a type of God who leaves disciples to battle on their own until they realize the folly of doing so, a type of God who takes disciples to places where all they can do is cry out in fear. But look at verse 27. We read, but immediately, there it is again, great word. But immediately Jesus spoke to them saying, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." Jesus is also this type of God. A God who enters our storms and responds to our cries when? Immediately. This leads to the fourth truth that comes out of this. Jesus enters our storms, but he enters our storms to teach us in the midst of them. In fact, uses them to teach us. Now, I've inferred to this already, the teaching of Jesus, but let's take a specific look at what Jesus is teaching, wants to teach, needs his disciples to see. His teaching begins in verse 27 with his reply. We've already read it. Let me read it one more time. "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." What is he teaching them in this? Well, that word or that phrase, "it is I," is the Greek ego me, literally I am. I am. What's so significant about that? Well, that name of God, ego me, I am, was introduced to us, more specifically Moses, when Moses was called by God to go into Egypt to set his people free. Moses asked the question, "Who shall I say sent me?" God responded, "Tell them I am sent you." I am that I am. It's a name of God that speaks of his self-existence. But It's the name of God, and please get this, because when names of God are introduced to us is as important as what they mean. When was the name I Am, that name of God, introduced to us? When God heard the cries of his people and he entered their plight. I've heard the cries of my people. I've heard them. Jesus heard the cries of some of his people here. Take courage, ego me. Take courage. But not only is Jesus sharing some things about his life and who he is and his character and his nature, he's also confronting them, wanting them to be expanded in their thought and understanding. He's talking about in this is what you believe about me, this is how you see me, but this is who I am. What do they think about Jesus and how do they need to be expanded in their thought? Well, they saw Jesus as a glorified pantry, a food truck. Ego of me. I am. You think of me as one you can force into position and secure your comfort. Ego of me. I am. You think of me as some sort of genie in a bottle. Ego of me. I am. I am the great I am for whom the very molecules that make up bread and fish replenish themselves when I command them to do so. I am the very I am for whom the very density of water recalibrates itself when I command it to do so. I'm the very great I am, as you will see, for whom the wind and the waves cease and die down when I command them to do so. I am that I am. I am that I am. And you need to get that. For if you don't, then you don't get me. And Jesus is saying to them, I am also the great I am who enters your storms. See, here's the thing about our God. Unlike every other God of every other faith, ism, philosophy, theology in our world, our God doesn't just reveal himself, he enters. Like, think about this. I am this God, and I'm coming to you in your storm. Like, think about that. I've heard your cry. Here I am. But at the same time, I love you too much to think of me like that. Because as Jesus says in John chapter 8, unless you believe that I am, you're still in your sins. Peter got it for a bit. This is what we see in verses 28 and 29. And Peter answered him, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water. Jesus said, come. So Peter got out of the boat, walked on the water, and came to Jesus. Now, before we hammer Peter, and we will, verse 30 is coming, let's just note this really important aspect of the story. At least he got out of the frickin' boat. You know what I'm saying? 11 others didn't. 11 others didn't. They stayed dry. Peter got out of the boat. Don't miss that. Did he fail later? Sure he did. He failed later. But I guarantee that he learned far more in his trying and failing than the other 11 did by not trying at all. I don't mean to offend you when I say this, but I'll take the chance for emphasis. That the church is full of people who have never failed, but in their spotless record haven't done a damn thing. So proud of their non-trying perfection. Peter got on the boat. See, sadly, there are far too many people who claim to follow Jesus who've never attempted anything that didn't work out. Do something that left them with egg on their face, led something that birthed detractors and the all too common, I told you so. But I would much rather run with people with some egg on their face. You know what I'm saying? Like wet garments. Like Peter had wet garments. I'd rather hang out with people who had wet garments. Failed, had some I told you so's in their rearview mirror. I'd rather run with people like that than those who never have attempted anything at all, or at least attempted anything that required faith. See, that's what I love about you guys, is you keep on attempting things, and it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I mean, the stories I hear about you, I mean, it's wonderful. I love being a part of this ministry. It's wonderful because it's chock full of people. Second use of chock today. It's chock, there's a third. Chock full of people that are full of faith and living it out. But if this doesn't resonate with you, follow the example of Peter and get out of the boat. To quote someone, and I can't remember the author, to walk on water, you got to get out of the boat. Earlier this week, I was down in Seattle at a conference where Rick Warren made a statement that I just love. You can see it on the screen. There is only one thing worse than failing, and that is the fear of failing. We must risk failing. I love that. We don't know how long Peter walked in the water. What we do know, however, is that when, verse 30, he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Save me. This is the verse that most people, when they're teaching this particular living parable, highlight as being, this is like the lesson, right? This is the takeaway. That when you're going through storms, don't take your eyes off Jesus, because when you take your eyes off Jesus, you'll begin to sink, right? If you've heard people teach on this particular living parable before, they've probably highlighted it. And I think that's a true statement. Go through storms, keep our eyes on Jesus. I mean, the writer of Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2 says, set your eyes, fix your eyes, your gaze. Look at Jesus, the author and the perfecter of your faith. So I think it's a good application. My problem with it is it doesn't go far enough. And I say that by noting verse 31, which encompasses question number 6 in our series. Verse 31, Jesus immediately reached out his hand, took hold of him, saying to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Oh, I don't know. You know what I mean? Because I'm walking on water and I've never done it before. I mean, like, why did I doubt? Hello? Look around. That's why. I don't do this all the time. And there's big 12-foot headers, right, coming over top, and Judas is mocking me from the boat. It's all that, right? It's that. And I've been reading some mainline liberal theologians that say that miracles don't take place and I should take this scene as more allegorical in nature. That's why I'm doubting, right? That's why I'm doubting. That's for all the seminary students. That joke right there for you. That's why I'm doubting, but not really. That's not why Peter doubted. Peter didn't doubt because of that. Why Peter doubted and began to sink. And it's not only because he took his eyes off Jesus, but he doubted and began to sink because he viewed the storm as being bigger than Jesus. Too big even for Jesus. The reason why I say that, Westside, is throughout this series, one of the things that we've tried to remind ourselves of is that Jesus asked questions, not for his sake, but for ours. He knew the predicament of Peter. He knew about the waves, and he's never walked on water and the storm and the wind and all of that. So he asked him a question because he wanted Peter to see, to dig deep, and ask him why, with the great I am with you, did you doubt? I just fed 15,000 people, at least 15,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. I just came to you in the storm by walking on the water. I command the very nuances of creation and they bow in due deference to me. I just called you. No, in fact, I commanded you to come and you came to a point. But in light of all that, you doubted. Peter, why did you still doubt? Westside, Peter didn't doubt and sink because the storm was too big. Peter doubted and sank because his Jesus, his view, his understanding, his perception of Jesus was too small. That's why I asked the question. He didn't just take his eyes off Jesus. He took his eyes off Jesus because he saw this as way bigger than the one he was looking at. There's no point fixing your eyes on a small Jesus. You know what I'm saying? So he said, I want you to see who I am. See me for who I am. I was hanging out with Serge, one of our elders. Serge is a great guy because he's an encyclopedia of Old Testament knowledge. And so we were having a bagel yesterday and talking and stuff, and we're going over this message, and he pointed out something I've never seen. I said, I love that. I'm going to share that, and I'll give you total credit. He just said, you know, also the fear, right, this fear of Peter in this storm so crippled him that it kept him from doing that which came naturally to him, not just supernaturally, right? Nobody walks on water, right? Nobody walks on water. That's supernatural. I mean, that's an absolute miraculous event. But the fear of Peter in the midst of the storm around him kept him from doing that which came naturally to Peter. What was that? Swimming. You know what I mean? Now, this is all Serge. This is not, don't give me any credit. Like, if you're going to tweet this, Serge, right? You got Moldovan man. I'm not sure what your handle is. Serge, I love you. All right, so that's this, right? Kept it, crippled him. Because in the Gospels, Peter swims in other places. He's a fisherman. He's a swimmer. He's a swimmer. But doesn't fear do that in the storms that we live in? I mean, fear will keep us from getting out of bed. Like cripple. When I say naturally, I don't mean that what we have, our abilities, don't come from God. Because what do we receive? What have we received or what do we have that we have not received? That everything is from, every good and perfect gift is from God. But those things that we, in God's grace, have. The fear of Peter in the midst of this kept him from doing even that. Westside, why does Jesus send us into storms, keep us in storms, even allow us for heightened fear in storms? For most often only a storm will show us the kind of faith and belief we have. Storms show us how we truly view Jesus. And it's a lesson that I've been in the midst of very recently. I don't usually share a lot of my story. I don't do that. Some people talk, why don't you share more stories? I don't know, because I already take enough time. I want to share part of my story, a very recent story, where this particular text has been hammering me. So just let me share some things that have taken place actually very recently. One of the blessings and curses, quote-unquote curses, not a big bad boy curse, but curses, is that I get to teach and preach the Bible every week, almost. A blessing, because I love to do it, love to do it. It's a privilege and an honor, and it is God's grace on my life. A curse, because oftentimes I'm walking through a text that's just kicking me in the teeth, and I have to live with it for a lot longer than you do, right? I'll tell you that. I'll get up on a Sunday and say, I've been living this since Monday. Here is it. Join me now. I'm going to kick you in the teeth with it, right? I mean, that's it, right? And sometimes it's weeks and weeks and weeks. This particular text has not only kicked me in the teeth, it just stepped on my neck. It's been a hard one. Let me explain why. I planted Westside 8 years ago. I didn't plant it alone. 5 adults, 2 kids. Planted Westside 8 years ago. I left a church in Burnaby that I was working at, sold our townhome that we were living in, and my wife, my 2 boys at that point, 2 years old, not quite 4 years old, moved to Vancouver to plant Westside. A year and a half into ministry, I received what I have shared before, without hesitation, was a word from the Lord. That word from the Lord, which I think is affirmed by 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, but that word from the Lord was that as long as we sent out people, money, time, gave of our time and resources, he, God, would keep drawing people in. That word was very important for me at that time, a year and a half in, because we were a fairly small ministry. But it served to undergird my commitment to planting churches, supporting churches, and giving myself to church planting endeavors and initiatives whenever it seemed good, right, pleasing, and perfect to do so. And thus we did. We planted Reality Vancouver. We planted a North Shore campus. We planted Christ City Church. We've given tens of thousands of dollars to The Rock in Squamish. We've given hundreds of thousands of dollars to the C2C network, a church planting network that I'm the chairman of from a BC standpoint and serve on the board from a national standpoint. I'm going to Toronto a week to do a bunch of teaching for a bunch of church planters next week. Lots of stuff, and I love doing it. But this undergirded it. Keep on giving time, resources, money, and so forth to this endeavor and what God has called you to. And true to his word, in the midst of sending out, God kept drawing in. We're not the biggest ministry in the world. We're not even close. Not the biggest ministry in Vancouver. Not even close. I get that. But this little thing has grown. It's grown abundantly, far beyond what I could have ever thought or imagined. 8 years of this, what a feast. 5 adults, 2 kids, think 5 loaves, 2 fish. That God has blessed, a lot of people fed, thousands. Thank you, Jesus. God's abundant grace and validation of his word continue to pour forth this year with the securing of this, the center. We felt called to this next step. We felt affirmed for this next step. We felt supported for this next step. And so we obeyed the voice of God, who we believe was calling us from Kits to go to the other side. And so we did. We believe Jesus said, come. And we did. And in going, I entered a storm that I had never experienced before. People have asked me countless times over the last number of months, you must be really fired up and excited about the center. And my response is always the same. I smile and I nod and I say, yes, I am, because I am. I'm very excited. But honestly, what I have felt most is pressure. I felt like there were waves crashing and wind blowing and 10,000 pounds on my back. Jesus sent me into a storm, but a necessary one. One that has evidenced that all too often I think Jesus is obligated to supply what I determine is most pressing in my life. A storm that has shown me that I think there are things too big even for Jesus. A storm that has been causing me to take my eyes off Jesus, doubt, and sink. I fasted for 30 days leading up to the launch of this ministry on September 29th. I was looking good. I was looking good, man. You couldn't bounce a quarter off my gut, but you could find it, and that wouldn't sink in. You know what I'm saying? It's pretty good, man. Take what you can get. And I went into launch Sunday, and it was great. But you know, after a wedding, there's a marriage. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're pro-marriage here. But there's a marriage. Weddings, fun, right? Fun, good, exciting. And it was. It was a great wedding. Launch Sunday, great wedding. But a marriage came with big space to fill. And financial pressures. And expectations, my own and others, to realize. And man, it was windy. Man, it was windy. And here's what I've been doing for the past 35 days. I've been really focused on the wind. And during this time, I've worked really hard to convince people into thinking that the meditation of my heart has been on Jesus, when most of all, it's been on the storm. And when you live like that, you know who suffers? Those closest to you. Because internal storms always erupt externally, don't they? question, where am I at today? Because you're going, okay, this wasn't 6 years ago. This is like now. Like, where are you? Well, I went away with the staff to a conference in Seattle this week, as I mentioned. Got down on Monday. I woke up on Tuesday. So we're talking 5 days ago. I woke up on Tuesday, woke up feeling like I've been feeling for the last 5-6 weeks, burdened. Pressure. But I began studying this text because it's my job, and also I love to do it. I wasn't running from Jesus, but I was feeling burdened. I'm going to the text. I get up early anyway, so if you're up at 4 o'clock, text me. We'll play Parcheesi together. I was up early. I was studying the text, going through this text, and here is the joy of this. God started getting a hold of me. So I spent a couple hours in the text. Then thereafter that morning, the conference started with the first speaker, Crawford Loritz, teaching out of Psalm 55. And you know what his topic was? Pressure. All right, here we go. And he started telling the story of David, who was in the midst of a storm of his own creation for the most part. And he started talking about the emotion of David coming out of that. A time, by the way, the storm that David entered, coming out of a time of success and growth, not out of his running and fleeing time from Saul, but a time out of great success and growth. And he started talking about David's frustration and isolation and anger and betrayal and humiliation. And it resonated with me. I had a kinship with David. I'm tracking. I'm relating. Understand, I'm not justifying those emotions. At that time, I was living them. I was living them. And then Crawford pointed out the drastic change in Psalm 55 and verse 16, which begins, "But I call to God, and the Lord will save me." Does this not sound like Peter in the water in verse 30 crying out, "Lord, save me. I'm in this storm." Evening and morning, at noon, I utter my complaint and moan, and he hears my voice. He redeems my soul in safety from the battle that I wage. Cast your burden on the Lord, and he will sustain you. And at that point, I began to weep. I know, big surprise, I cried. Nicole's my witness. And the Spirit began working on my life, showing me things, reminding me of others, and tenderly working on me. And I say tenderly because I want you to notice in verse 31 that when Jesus asks Peter the question, what is he doing at the same time? He's extending his hand and pulling him out. Don't miss the tenderness of that. Sometimes we just drop back. Why do you doubt? No, that's not Jesus. Why do you doubt? And the Spirit started doing that in my life. And I'm sitting in the very back of this old school church eating Reasons, because I like Reasons while I'm at conferences. And I'm eating Reasons, right? Jolly Ranchers, black licorice. And the Spirit just starts working. Spirit just starts working in my life and reminding me and working on me. I don't know what the purpose of the conference was for anyone else, but God, through his word, through his servants, and the Spirit of Jesus, got a hold of me and pulled me out of a place that I had been drowning in for the past month and a half. Thereafter, that's Tuesday morning. Thereafter, well, in his sovereign grace, God allowed me to get up in the morning and continue studying and working through this text. And then throughout the day, as the conference continued, repent and worship and reflect and converse and be challenged by other great preachers who reminded me of how small storms are in the shadow of our God and King Jesus. This is nothing. Nothing. This is nothing. In the shadow of Jesus. Which leads to the final point coming out of this living parable, that is, Jesus calms our storms. picking things up in verse 31, we read to verse 32, Jesus immediately reached out his hand, took hold of him, saying, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Excuse me. And when they got in the boat, the wind ceased. Jesus sends, Jesus leaves. Jesus enters, Jesus teaches, and finally Jesus calms. Maybe not right away, but he does and he will. In fact, he took our place in the ultimate of storms so that we could forever and will forever enjoy peace. Our call, turn our eyes back to him. Our call, cry out to him. Our call, take hold of his hands. Our call, don't miss the lesson that we need to learn in the midst of our storms. How big is your Jesus? I need to close. You don't have to be a master theologian to recognize the obvious questions of application coming out of this text, do you? You've got to figure it out. You'll go through them in your post-Sunday content this week with your community group, some of them. But let me ask some as we wrap up. You in any storms right now? Any storms? It's really a silly question because I know that you're in storms because I know many of your stories. You sinking? Faithless? Fearful? Why do you doubt? Could it possibly be that it's not the size of the storm that's your problem, but the size of the God you've created? Possibly. Crawford Loritz, in the sermon I referenced a moment ago, made the comment in the midst of that same sermon, courage isn't the absence of fear, but where it's directed. See, we either direct our fear toward the storm or we direct it towards God. Where is your fear being directed? As someone said, fear, in fact, can be a form of idolatry where we make more of it, whatever we're going through, than God himself. Where we bow down to the storm and take our eyes off Jesus. Where is your fear being directed? A last thing to note from this living parable is that it doesn't actually end with Peter and Jesus climbing into the boat, but with worship. You see that in verse 33? Peter and Jesus get in the boat, wind ceases, the disciples saying of Jesus, "You truly are the Son of God." Oh, now you get it. Now you get it. Thank you. That whole 15,000 feeding thing, not good enough. Now you get it. Good for you. And what would Jesus say thereafter if we saw it written? You should be worshiping me. It's right to worship me. Because this is who I am. The Son of the living God. So what should we do? What in fact is the right thing to do as we go through storms? What we should be doing in the midst of the storm and as we journey through the storm and arrive on the other end, we should worship Jesus. So would you rise as we worship Jesus in light of what Jesus has taught us through his word?